Welcome to Elite Wrestling Radio. I'm Hotshot Danny Duggan, and we are back with episode 3 of our weekly podcast series. And what an episode we have this week. It might be our biggest one to date. I know it's going to be our most controversial one to date, as later today, we're going to be on the phone with the controversial Mecca Shane Madison. We're going to be addressing his career and some questions about that career that has spanned well over 15 years across North America. But first, let's get down to business. Canadian Wrestling's Elite just wrapped up a great event at Rookie Sports Bar this past Friday night. This was our fifth event there, and this is something I keep saying after each and every event, and it's because it keeps ringing true. The audience grew once again. They got more loud. They got more rambunctious, and things just continue to get bigger, wilder, and crazier at Rookie Sports Bar in Transcona. So this past Friday night, we saw a lot of good matches take place. It's a longer show with it being in the bar, and we get to have some more fun because we're not so time-constrained the way we are with our television tapings. And we saw a lot of good wrestling on this night, an amazing tag team main event between Man and AJ Sanchez and Kevy Chevy. It lived up to the hype. Fantastic tag team contest with the Big Sexy Beast coming out on top in a battle for tag team supremacy. We also saw some interesting developments as Misfit Mike Mission was challenging Robbie Royce for the CWE Championship. But earlier in the evening, called out Robbie Royce, saying he's only made it a year as champion because he's never stepped in the realm of hardcore and extreme with some of the likes of Mike Mission. And it was made on the spot that later that night, the CWE Championship would be defended under hardcore, no disqualification rules. And that match went all over the bar with some brutality from both men that ultimately saw the pissed off pitbull Robbie Royce defeat SOA member Misfit Mike Mission to cap off what's been an amazing 1 year as CWE champion, as he goes into the fifth anniversary show looking to further that reign going into year two of this historic reign by Robbie Royce. Some other things that took place on that Friday night, myself was in action as I did battle with Stefan Epic, who had the coach Kelly Russell in his corner. I was the victor by disqualification after the coach Kelly Russell got involved in the match. But the bigger story here is Stefan Epic did suffer a severe injury and had to be carried out by officials. I guess I punched him in the face so hard he popped one of his ribs. So that's some of the action that went down at Rookie Sports Bar. We're going to be back on Friday, March 21st. So mark that on the calendar. Get down to Rookie Sports Bar because these shows are getting hotter and hotter, and they're going to continue to get bigger as 2014 moves on. CWE 5th anniversary tour is right around the corner. We're now getting very close. We're just under 4 weeks away, 5 shows in 5 days across Manitoba, and some announcements have started to come through for that. And the first of those two announcements being we're going to see two of the top stars from the southern United States making their Canadian wrestling debuts, a part of that 5-show tour. Sigmund from Knoxville, Tennessee, and The Gift, Jason Kincaid from West Virginia, are going to be coming up to Manitoba, appearing in Canada for the first time and going head-to-head with the Elite and CWE. These are two men that have developed an amazing reputation and track record across the southern United States. If you want to talk about West Virginia, Tennessee, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, these men have been there and they've held championships there. So we're going to get a unique diverse style from two men we've never seen before, and they're going to be put into the shuffle to make things very interesting over those 5 days. Stay tuned as opponents get a name for those guys for those 5 matches. And other announcements that have been made, the Masterpiece Chris Masters, his first opponents have been named in Neepawa, Manitoba. Chris Masters will go one-on-one with Big Sexy Beast Kevy Chevy. So you've got Chris Masters, the established world-recognized superstar, getting in the ring with a man who's recognized across Canada as the hardest hitter and one of the most brutal and violent men in a professional wrestling ring. So I'm very interested to see how that match unfolds. And it'll be a change of pace the next night for Chris Masters as he goes to Morden, Manitoba, with his announced opponent named earlier today, Kamikaze. So definitely a vast array of styles coming towards Chris Masters. Some big matches to be had. Stay tuned to CWECanada.ca as the final 3 participants who are going to go up against the Masterpiece will be announced in the coming days. And all the information for that tour is also at www.CWECanada.ca. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be on the line with the Mecca, Shane Madison. are back, and it's going to get a little hot in the kitchen because on the line I have the controversial Mecca Shane Madison. Welcome to the show. Well, you're somebody I have a long history with myself. We haven't always seen eye to eye. We've definitely done our battles, and the last one of those being the last time you were seen in Canadian Wrestling's Elite and haven't been seen from since. Where is Shane Madison?
Shane Madison's still around. Shane Madison's in the shadows lurking like he always is. I'm keeping tabs on what's going on here locally. And, the wrestling business is something that you don't retire from. It retires from you. So I would imagine that some... I will always be involved with professional wrestling at some level.
So you've been in professional wrestling for a long time now. I think we're looking at 15, 16 years. Before you became a professional wrestler, you did attend local wrestling events. What are some of your first memories of local wrestling before getting into the business?
I can remember there was an event at Lord Roberts Community Club, and it was June of 1994. And it was a River City Wrestling show, and I remember I thought it was really funny because I'd never gone to a local show before, and I remember the ropes on the ring were garden hose, and I thought that was really funny. Yellow garden hose. It was a nice touch. And I went up to the promoter at the time, and I spoke with him, and I said, you know, look, I'd like to get involved. What can I do? Can I help out? Can I, you know, take tickets at the door? Can I sell programs? Can I set up the ring? Can I do this? Can I do that? And he kind of brushed me off a little bit and told me to call a gentleman named Dave Pinsky. So he gave me this guy's phone number. I had called Dave Pinsky, left him a message, left him a few messages, and never heard back from him. So at that point, I just stopped going to local shows. That was the only time I had ever actually gone to one.
So you approached a promoter, you wanted to get into professional wrestling, you were turned away. How did you go about getting into the business from there instead of just deciding not to do it?
About 3 years later, I've been watching wrestling since I was real small, and it was something I always liked, and I'm not even sure how it happened, but I really got involved in it and really started paying attention to it closely in the mid-80s, and so fast forward after that encounter in June of 94, we go to October of 97, and I'm pretty good with dates. Bobby J, who has been wrestling all over the place and is a good friend of mine, he was bartending at a nightclub called Doubles Fun Club. And I went to see him. I remember this because my girlfriend drove me there. I didn't have a car yet. She drove me there. And she waited in the parking lot, and I talked to Bobby J, and I told him, look, I want to get into this. What do I got to do? I was very hungry. I wanted to do anything. And Bobby J, and he doesn't even remember this. We laugh about this now, but he basically kind of eyed me up and down. And at the time, I was about, maybe a buck 60, buck 75 or something, somewhere around there. And he just basically said, take a hike. And that kind of pissed me off, rubbed me the wrong way. So what I did was I said, you know, I'm gonna show him, and I'm gonna get into this somehow. But it's not gonna be. It looks like it's not gonna be locally here.
Why do you think they were so hard headed to letting you into the professional wrestling business? Like, no disrespect to other wrestlers at the time, but there were a lot of small wrestlers in Winnipeg wrestling, and very few of them had a great physique, if any physique, at the time. So why were they so hard on you getting into the business when others were already taking that path and involved?
I think when I started wrestling, there were two sort of sections of guys or of wrestlers. There were sort of like Tony's guys who had been on TV, who had some exposure, who kind of looked more like your prototypical wrestler. And then there were, quote unquote, the local guys, smaller guys, guys that didn't look all that good, guys that hadn't had that TV exposure. And I think he probably just looked at me and, you know, I might have done the same thing and probably would have just, you know, laughed at me and said, you know, we don't need another one of these, you know, skinny hacks wrestling around town here. So, you know, and I wish more promoters did that, actually, because what did I do? I didn't just go knock on the next guy's door and the next guy's door and the next guy's door waiting for somebody to give me an opportunity. I went and I did the things I needed to do to improve myself, to improve my appearance, to improve, to show them I was serious. And it certainly paid off about a year later.
So you decided to make the move to Windsor, Ontario. You know, at that time, the internet was just starting to come around. You know, finding a wrestling school definitely wasn't easy in 1997, 1998. How did you get hooked up with Windsor, Ontario, of all places?
What happened was I had a mutual friend named Justin, who is a good friend of mine, a mutual friend with another guy named Jeff Cavanaugh, who lives in Windsor, and he's been around the wrestling business for years and years and years. And I was over at Justin's house one day. We were watching Survivor Series 1996. I remember that. And then Jeff called Justin out of the blue, and I guess they grew up in Southern Ontario together, and I just happened to be over there. And they started talking, and then Jeff said, "Oh, my other line's beeping. Hold on a sec." And he went on the other line, and then Justin says, "This is the weirdest thing. My buddy Jeff called from Windsor. He's a big wrestling fan. I'm going to see if he still wrestles." So when Jeff came back on, Justin talked to him a little bit more and found out not only, you know, had he trained to be a wrestler, he was a referee. Now, Jeff was, he'll be the first to tell you, he's no Ric Flair. He's not exactly a wrestler, but his thoughts were, if you're going to be a referee, you should be trained how to wrestle. So he was reffing, and then I flew down to Windsor initially in February of 97, and I met with Jeff and Scott D'Amore, and then I flew down again in August of 97, met with them again. I went down there a couple times to check it out, to scope things out, and they knew I was serious, and they knew I really wanted to do this. And then I was supposed to go down in April of 98, but I didn't have a lot of money at the time, so I just opted to hold back and save some more cash, and I flew down there in October of 1998. Scott did not have his school going. That was the school that I would have went to, but he did not have a school going, so he recommended that I talk to or I go with Jeff, who Scott works very closely with and still does, and also a gentleman by the name of Harry Neubecker, who wrestled as Professor Maxwell. He's been all over Japan, and he's been all over the place. So Jeff, I credit to teaching me the psychology and sort of some of the finer details, while Harry sort of taught me the mechanics in the ring.
So what are some of your memories from training in Windsor, and some of your first matches from the area when you did begin wrestling?
Oh, I remember, we trained in, my class started, we had about 10 guys, and of course, you get all these guys, and they come in, and, you know, we had this one guy who came in with, like, a Sting mask, and he had his little Sting gloves, and, you know, he was all decked out in all the wrestling gimmicks, and he was ready to train. And then by the end of the class, or by the end of the training session, there was only two of us left. Everyone else dropped out, because if everybody could do it, everybody would be doing it. It's not easy. It's not ballet, as they say. So I remember training in a shitty ring that didn't have a spring. It was a boxing ring that they converted into a wrestling ring. It was in a cold warehouse. I had to wear multiple layers of clothing just to work in this thing. We didn't even get in the ring for the first little while because they thought we didn't deserve to get in the ring until we knew how to do some chain wrestling, which, you know, if you're a student of the game, you can tell someone's the shits, you know, by watching their chain wrestling. So they didn't just, you know, all these guys, they want to get in the ring and hit the ropes and do a bunch of moves. That's not the way I was trained. So we sort of started very slowly, very gradual. You know, I actually went down there with another guy from Winnipeg, and things didn't work out for him so good. So he flew back, and I was down there from October of 98 to April of 99 when I was done. I said, okay, what are we doing today? And they go, well, we've kind of taught you what you need to know. You got to kind of apply it now. Like, you don't get a certificate saying you graduated. You just got to kind of go and use it now. So here you go. And I had a couple matches down there already. So I moved back home in April of 99. That was it.
Who were some of your first matches in the area?
My first match ever was January 10th, 1999, in Warren, Michigan, at a bar. It was a Saturday afternoon show, and there was a bad blizzard in Michigan, and what happened was a bunch of guys couldn't make it in, so they needed a guy, and I'd only been training for 3 months at that point, which in Winnipeg would actually make you a veteran, but down there, that doesn't mean shit, so I said, you know, I don't know, I'm not ready. And they go, no, you have to do this. And you're going to be wrestling your trainer, and it's just going to be a squash and this and that. And I said, I have no wrestling gear. My big thing was I didn't want to be like one of these bags of goo who wrestles in a track pants and a undershirt and a pair of sneakers. So what I did was I borrowed some, you know, boots from this guy, some trunks from this guy, and we put something together. And I had my little attires, my little red and yellow singlets that Jeff Kavanaugh so eloquently says it looks like my McNuggets are hanging out of them. It looked like Ronald McDonald's singlet. And then we needed to come up with a name for myself. So we were driving downtown in Detroit, and we drove by Clyde's Carpets. So Harry came up with this name, Flying Freddy Clyde. So I debuted in January of 99 against my trainer, and he beat the shit out of me, and but I made him look good, and that's really that was my first match. But I had some other matches down there. I wrestled a few times in Ohio, did a bunch of shows in Michigan for NWA Michigan. I did a three ring. Geez, how many guys were in that battle royal? It was a three ring, I think, 60 man battle royal. It was crazy, and I got the piss beat out of me in that one. And you know, it was really cool because you had guys like, you know, Truth Martini, he was down there, and Jimmy V, and a bunch of guys that, you know, probably don't mean anything here, but a bunch of guys that I got to learn from down there who've been wrestling for years and years and years. So, yeah, and then I came back in April.
So you finished training, you're starting to work on shows, you're starting to make some leeway, you're branching out Michigan, Ohio, you're starting to get to work with some better talent. Why did you ultimately decide to move back to a city that's geographically in the middle of nowhere in the wrestling world?
Yeah, that's about it. And the difference between me and a lot of these other guys is a lot of these other guys say, well, you know, Shane Madison didn't go and pursue this, or he didn't do that, or he didn't do anything. And see, I'm different than all these other guys that are involved in wrestling, is that I actually have a education, and I have a career, and I always had good, well-paying jobs. So the idea of me going on the road and, you know, not making any money and not trying to further my career or my livelihood or my life or my lifestyle was never sort of in the cards for me. I always looked at wrestling as a business. I realized to get to that next level, there's certain sacrifices that you have to make, but you know, at the time I was, you know, 22 years old or so, and I had a girlfriend, and I was homesick, and I just wanted to kind of be back home. So when I got back home in April, I didn't actually wrestle again till September because, you know, where do you go? You know, I didn't know if, you know, River City Wrestling was still around, and I sort of tried to do a little bit of research, and I found some other companies were around, and I ended up hooking up with company called the Canadian Wrestling Federation in May of 99, just to kind of brush up on some ring time. And that's where I sort of landed, I guess, when I got back to Winnipeg.
So what were some of the immediate differences you noticed coming from Windsor and coming back to Winnipeg?
I think the guys in Winnipeg weren't as polished. They almost had like a gang mentality. You come back, you know, in Windsor and Detroit, it was sort of like a family mentality. And here, like, I remember when I went to the CWF, you know, it was a bunch of big, you know, supposed tough guys, and, you know, I'm this smaller guy and this new guy, and, you know, this guy was trained down here. So it's like almost they want to take a couple rounds out of you to see if you're a tough guy or whatever. But you know, I just kind of took all that in stride. I think I was sort of brought up in the business where I sort of, people let me know that those people are out there. And the reason why some people are out there and act like that is because, you know, they've had some shortcomings in their life or their career. So they like to take it out on the new guy, I guess. I can remember one time when I was at a River City Wrestling show, and I walked into the back, and I was, you know, always very respectful and very courteous, and I was always grateful to have a spot and opportunity. And I had my gear bag, and I started unpacking my stuff. And I remember one of the wrestlers who isn't exactly in peak physical condition, he looked at me and he said, "You work out or something?" I'm thinking like, yeah, you kind of are trying to be a professional. You're trying to portray yourself like you're an athlete. You don't just show up and get in the ring and do this. Like, so I thought that was kind of funny. You know, all these guys are wearing, you know, their little soccer kick pads and their shooter boots and their cut-off jeans. And I actually had a pair of wrestling trunks and a pair of wrestling boots, and so there was just some things like that that I noticed. And actually, Scott D'Amore said to me when I came back here, he said, because Don Callis was training some guys, and Scott said to me, don't get in the ring with anyone up there except Don's guys. They're all the shits. And I was able to do that for the first couple of shows, but then you just can't keep wrestling the same guys every now and then, so you got to change it up. So you learn to sort of adapt and protect yourself if you're working with someone who might have had some shortcomings.
So you eventually did find a home in the 1999 River City Wrestling crew. How did you go from training with the CWF in May to landing a full-time spot with Wayne Stanton in River City Wrestling?
Well, what happened was the promoter of Canadian Wrestling Federation, his name is Ernie Todd. I guess he had a training facility on Jarvis Avenue in Winnipeg. And I'd been down a few times and worked out with some of their guys, and I had some good sessions, you know, with them, and a bunch of, for the most part, some good guys. And Ernie took me aside one day, and he said, well, you know, I don't know what you know or where you're from, but around here, we got to sign you to a contract. So we're not sure if we're going to sign you to a wrestler contract or a developmental trainee contract. So I'll have to, you know, we need to discuss this. So I kind of looked at him, and I basically said, you know, in a nice way, trying to be respectful, well, unless you're paying me a salary, I'm not signing any contract. And, you know, with all due respect, there's probably nothing that Ernie Todd can teach me that I haven't already been shown down in Windsor. So that kind of ended that. I kind of just stopped showing up. And so maybe me and Ernie didn't get off to the best starts. We had a few run-ins in the future, but so I just wasn't doing anything. And then at the time, I was going to university, the University of Manitoba, and I ran into a guy by the name of, who wrestles around here, is Playboy Will Damon. I saw him at the gym, and he said to me, I met him, I can't remember, a few months before. He said, hey, what are you doing? And I go, I don't know, just working out. And he goes, no, what are you doing with wrestling? And I go, he knew I had trained or whatever. And I said, you know, I'm not really doing anything. I don't know. And he's like, I work for this company called River City Wrestling. You should come down. I think, you know, you'd like it. And I go, oh, okay, well, when's the next show? He goes, tonight. And they're running shows on Monday nights at Bumper's Bar. It's like a strip joint bar type establishment on Ellis. And I go, okay. So he's like, I'll pick you up at, 7. And then he picked me up, and I met Donnie DiCaprio. And I guess that from there on out, we were sort of the three musketeers of local wrestling.
So you went down to Bumper's Bar. Did you end up wrestling on that show that night, or was it just an introductory process at that point?
I went down, and I met Wayne, and I said hello, and I sort of, you know, saw all the guys. And, you know, Wayne, as a promoter, he's not a stupid guy. I mean, he looked at me, and he saw a guy who was in decent shape, good-looking kid, right? He'd be a fool to not put me on his show. And I guess the booker at the time, Mike Davidson, had pushed to get me on the show. And I guess what ended up happening was one of Wayne's guys got bumped. And Wayne said, you don't bump my guys for Don's guys, because I was sort of lumped in with Don Callis' trainees. So one of the Wayne's guys got bumped. I worked a match with J.C. Dirksen. Opening match, I did a job to a power bomb. J.C. Dirksen, devastating power bomb. And he gave me a power bomb, and that was that. And I guess I had a good enough showing. I was invited back next week, and Mike wanted to work a program with me, so he did a 3-week program, which actually drew, it's funny to say this, but me and Mike Davidson drew big business in 1999 at Bumper's. Where, you know, we had about 300 people there on a Monday night consecutively. We did a, you know, 1 week he won, then I won, or I can't remember. Anyways, there was the final match was a brass knucks in a box match. It was getting close to Christmas time, and I had came up with this idea where you had four presents in each corner, and in one of those boxes is a pair of brass knuckles. So, you know, you're wrestling the match, and you're clawing over to one box, and of course, we all know where the brass knuckles are. So the three boxes are open. There's no brass knuckles. There's one present left. Everybody knows the brass knuckles are in that box. So what ended up happening was I got the box first, and I punched Mike out and knocked him out with the brass knucks. And that was that. So that was the end of that segment. And then Mike ended up booking, and Mike was, I guess I had impressed Mike enough where he took good care of me there, and Wayne took good care of me, and I just kind of put my head down and did what I was told.
To backtrack a little bit here, you mentioned the name J.C. Dirksen. That's a name that's come up 3 weeks in a row now on Elite Wrestling Radio, first with Mentolo, A.J. Sanchez, and now yourself. Do you have a J.C. Dirksen story for us?
Well, you'll have to get him in for, you know, this is episode three. You'll have to get him in for episode four. Personally, I don't know why he wasn't episode one, but one J.C. Dirksen story I will tell you, and I don't talk to Dirksen all that much. I don't know what happened with him. He's one of those weird cats. It's like we were cool, and then we weren't cool, and then he heard. This wrestling business is funny. It's like a soap opera, right? And I'm a pretty laid-back guy, and if someone wants to talk to me, great. If someone has heat with me, great. I don't have heat with them. I really don't care. But so I guess, you know, when I see Dirksen, we still talk and we say hi, but I don't know. He's just kind of weird to me nowadays. But anyways, what happened was, I remember we wrestled at the University of Manitoba. It was September the 13th, 1999. It was an afternoon show, and it was me and Chris Stevens, who was Chris Kotex, because Don named him after a maxi pad, which is pretty funny. Myself and Chris Kotex taking on the Backstreet Bullies, Dirksen and Donnie DiCaprio and BJ Monroe, as Dirksen was called. And I remember Dirksen, he tagged in, and he grabbed my arm, and he gave me an arm wringer, and I thought, holy shit, this guy's a stiff prick. And he was just wrenching on my arm like he was going to take it home with him. It was just agonizing working with that guy, and he's kicking me in the corner, and he's just booting the shit out of me. He's caving my chest in. I'm like, who the fuck trained this guy, you know? But let's just say Dirksen worked a little snug. Let's just leave it at that.
So you're now in the River City Wrestling mix. Mike Davidson's taking care of you. Wayne Stanton's taking care of you. As they were starting to gain some traction in the community clubs, you were partnered up with a man by the name of Johnny Malibu. Was that a Booker's decision or something you and Johnny Malibu came together and said, hey, let's give this a shot?
I think if I'm remembering correct, I think just Wayne wanted, I guess, a tag team put together. So he came up with this idea of have me team up with Johnny Malibu. So we teamed up and we won the River City Wrestling tag team titles and actually went undefeated. We never lost those titles, so I can still claim I am a River City Wrestling tag team champion to this day, going on 15 years now. Just something that just sort of happened. We were thrown together. I can't remember what the situation was, but seemed to work. And you know, I got along great with Malibu. He's a great guy. Wayne was sort of booking him as sort of the Rob Van Dam of Winnipeg. I remember he used to call the little Winnipeg Yellow Pages wrestling hotline, and Wayne would always talk about, come see Johnny Malibu, and, you know, you think you're seeing, the way he talks about him, you thought he was Rob Van Dam, you know, all these innovative moves, and then you come down and, oh, it's Johnny Malibu, so.
So shortly after that, you went undefeated as River City Wrestling Tag Team Champion because River City Wrestling ended up being sold to Ernie Todd and the CWF, a man you had bumped into a little bit earlier in your career. Take us back in time to what the environment was like upon hearing that decision that River City Wrestling was closing up, because it was mounting some traction at the time.
Yeah, it was doing good. I mean, CWF had all sort of the older guys, and the older guys were sort of the established guys, and they were just boring. They were boring to watch. I mean, no one wants to, I mean, wrestling was hot, right? No one wanted to watch a bunch of middle-aged guys roll around in the ring. I mean, so what we did was we had a younger crew, a hungrier crew, a crew that wanted to learn, and I guess the crowd could relate to them more. So, but at the end of the day, wrestling's a business, and Wayne Stanton, the promoter of River City Wrestling, he was losing money, and Ernie presented an opportunity for Wayne to sell the business and get out of it and make a little dough. And, you know, Wayne was losing money, and Wayne did it. And at the time, you know, I remember my feelings being really hurt. And the whole crew kind of felt betrayed. And at that time, I was kind of almost, I'd say almost the like the captain of the River City Wrestling team. I just sort of found myself as the captain of the team. And remember, I called Wayne. I left him a pretty harsh message on his voicemail, not understanding, you know, this guy is pouring his blood, sweat, and tears and money into this company. He's not making a dime, and he's doing this just for out of the goodness of his heart to let some young guys get an opportunity and roll around and get some experience. And I didn't understand what was happening. So there were some hurt feelings there. Ernie bought the company. And I guess he had invited the guys to come down to Chalmers Community Center, which is where they were running shows at the time. And I remember he basically put like out a veiled threat that, the River City Wrestling guys, the disrespectful River City Wrestling guys, are going to be shown who's the boss type of thing. When they come down, and we had to come down because they own the company and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we were part of them now. And I just basically, people were asking me, you know, what are you doing? I go, well, I'm not going down there. I've been down there. I know what this guy is all about. I think he's a joke. So if you guys want to go right ahead. But, you know, me, DiCaprio, and Damon, we weren't going anywhere. We were sticking together. We had hoped that something would develop. And sure enough, Bobby J stepped up to the plate and founded Top Rope Championship Wrestling in April of 2000. And we returned to Bumpers that month, I believe it was.
So Top Rope Championship Wrestling is off and running. Pretty much the entire River City Wrestling crew then became Top Rope Championship Wrestling, minus a couple guys that decided to go over and work for Ernie. And this ended up spawning, you know, Winnipeg Wrestling Wars, and the fact that both Top Rope Championship Wrestling and the CWF were running the exact same venue week or biweekly. What are some of your memories from that Winnipeg Wrestling War at Chalmers Community Club?
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. At the time, our crew was all full of piss and vinegar, and we wanted to, you know, show these guys who were sort of the established guys, the guys who had been around for a long time, we wanted to show them what we were all about, and we sort of took the ball and ran with it. And, those established guys, at first, they were just, these are a bunch of punk kids, they're a non-factor. But what happened was, we started chipping away at these guys, and, you know, the CWF was still running good shows. I mean, there were still people going to their shows, not like people weren't watching. But Don Callis was running his No Holds Barred events with Joe Aiello, and, you know, we were getting on those shows. Those CWF guys weren't getting on those shows. And then, you know, Nelson Mayer was running IWA shows or whatever it was, the Indigenous Wrestling Alliance. They were running shows, and we were getting on those shows, and Ernie's guys weren't getting on those shows. So I think a lot of those guys in the CWF were kind of looking over at these punk kids and were like, you know, why are these guys getting to do all these shows and getting these opportunities, and we're still, you know, we're just here. I mean, what's going on? So not only that, the houses that we had, they were growing. They were growing rapidly, and Bobby J was a go-getter. He wanted to make this thing go. I mean, you know, kudos to Bobby. I mean, Bobby didn't have to start up a wrestling company. I remember Bobby came in, it was February of 2000 into River City Wrestling. It was the first time I had ever met him since the time where he brushed me off at doubles years ago. And he just wanted to come around and see what was going on. I think he was working for Ernie at the time, and he liked our crew and liked what we had going. And, you know, who knows, maybe he knew something was in the works and he just wanted to see who we'd be working with. And, you know, thank God for Bobby J. Bobby J doesn't get enough credit because he started up Top Rope Championship Wrestling and gave a lot of guys, myself included, a great opportunity.
So Top Rope Championship Wrestling is the first place you really hit your stride and came into your own as a main event player for a wrestling company. How was that transition from coming from Windsor to Winnipeg to River City Wrestling to becoming the main event of TRCW, a part of its boom?
Well, the thing is, like, I never asked to be in main events. I guess you get into this business to kind of be the guy wherever you are. I mean, I always thought, you know, I always had confidence in myself. But, I mean, no offense to some of these other guys, but the promoters are going to book and push who are guys who are reliable, guys who look like professionals. I mean, look at the dilemma that you have, Danny. I mean, you're running Canadian Wrestling's Elite, and a lot of people looking on the outside in are going, piece of shit, you're putting yourself over. You're just having yourself in all the main events, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know you're going to show up at that show. You know you're going to be there. You know you can rely on yourself. You know you're going to be in the gym. You know you take it seriously. You know you're going to deliver a good match. So these are all factors that promoters take into consideration. So a lot of these guys, let's face it, the wrestling business is an aesthetic business. And, you know, they're going to push guys that look good, guys that can talk good, guys that can draw money, guys that can connect with the people. They're going to push guys like that, and I happen to be one of those guys. So I'm a pretty easy guy to work with. I don't really ask for much, you know. I've been guilty when I was younger of, you know, being pretty stubborn and pig-headed and, you know, maybe being a little abrasive at times, but I don't think that's not because I'm a dick. That's because I care about what I'm doing and I'm passionate about what I'm doing. So, you know, Bobby, I guess we did a little thing, and Bobby ended up putting the TRCW strap on me, and I had it for, I beat the axe for it in July of 2000, and I held on to it till October, and my buddy Will Damon took it off me, and you know, and that was that.
So you mentioned earlier the trio that was formed, you know, as you started coming around River City Wrestling between yourself, Playboy Will Damon, and Donnie DiCaprio. That trio would then go on to be MVP in Top Rope Championship Wrestling. How did that formation of this super group that had such an impact on Manitoba wrestling come to be?
Well, we were always buddies. Like, we not only do we hang out in wrestling, but we hang out outside of wrestling. So, you know, we bounce ideas off of guys. I mean, DiCaprio and Damon, they're hungry guys. I mean, they wanted to be like the showstoppers on the shows. They wanted to have the best matches. They wanted to, you know, they were trained by Don Cal, so they were trained obviously the right way. So, I don't know how it all came about. What happened was, we were wrestling at, the Palladium, and, Bobby J approached me and he said, I'd like to turn you heel. And I said, you know, whatever you want to do. And Mike Davidson was booking, and I was going to be working a program with, TJ Bratt, who was a baby, or was a heel at the time. They were going to flip him to babyface. And Bratt was a pretty paranoid guy, and he was always thinking that Davidson was out to screw him and sabotage him and this and that. And he said, you know, I'll never get over as a babyface. And Mike's like, you know, you just have to look at it. What guy who goes drinking in a bar is going to cheer for a guy like me? Nobody. Nobody's going to cheer for a guy who's in shape, who, you know, has muscles, who has a nice tan, who's got, you know, proper ring attire. They're going to cheer for the guy who looks like them, the guy who looks like he goes out binge drinking every night and swears and, you know, body slams women. I mean, they're going to cheer for a guy like that. They're going to get behind a guy like that. Look at Steve Austin. He made millions of dollars. So we just followed that formula, and I ended up turning on Brad. We formed the group, and at the time when we formed MVP, there was like 40 people in the crowd. There was no one at that Palladium. There was nothing happening there. And then what happened was, over the course of a few months, when we peaked in July of 2001, myself and Brad in the main event, we had 460 people sponsored by the Winnipeg Sun. I mean, it was packed in there. I still have the tape, and, I popped in the match, and I was with another guy who's not wrestling anymore, and he looked at it, and he goes, where the hell was this? And I said, that's the Palladium. He goes, that's the Palladium? Because by the time he started wrestling there was nothing happening there. So, so we just clicked inside and out of the ring. We stuck together. We knew that there was strength in numbers. We negotiated, you know, raises as a group, as a tandem. We got Ernie thinking we might jump over to the CWF one time, and we ended up getting a nice raise from Bobby J out of it. We never had any intention of moving, but hey, if we can get a couple more bucks, right? I mean, you're never going to make money in this business. And I think everybody who gets into the local wrestling thing and they're going to make money, you need to give your head a shake, because you're going to lose tons of money. You know what? You should be compensated fairly for your time and what you put into the business, but don't be expecting to make money. And I just wanted to have, you know, a little bit of money just so that, you know, the promoter was appreciative of my efforts, and because I was certainly appreciative of theirs.
So at the time, you weren't an angle with T.J. Brad. He's somebody that you had an on-again, off-again relationship through the entirety of your wrestling careers. During that angle with T.J. Brad at the Palladium, were you two getting along?
Windsor with me to initially train. And what happened was, you know, I was planning on going down in October, and Brat was, you know, back and forth. I don't want to go, and I should go. I don't want to go. And he had some personal stuff going on at the time, apparently. And then one day, like, of course, he didn't have a pot to piss in. He had no money. So there was a seat sale on these flights, and I said to him, look, I mean, this seat sale's up at midnight. I'm going to buy my ticket. You need to tell me if you want to come do this, because if you do, I'll buy your ticket. You can pay me back. Big mistake there. But anyways, he said, yeah, okay, I'll come. So I ended up buying the two tickets. We flew down to Windsor. We got down there. We're looking for a place to stay. We're looking for an apartment. Thank God we didn't get one, because the first couple days of training, Brat went, I think, the first or second day. And before training, you know, what does an athlete do? Well, you might not want to have a protein shake, maybe bring a Gatorade or a bottle of water when you're going to go do some physical activity. Brat goes to 7-Eleven, pile drives two Big Bite hot dogs with chili and a freaking extra large Big Gulp root beer. Right? So we go to training, and I guess I think that day we were taking a few bumps. Guy gets out of the ring. He looks like pale, like nobody's business, barfs everywhere. He's on a flight home the next day. He just bails. So now I'm down there by myself. That apartment that I was going to get, I can't get because I can't afford it, because there's just one income. Of course, I had a job down there. I actually prepared myself when I went down there. I had a job lined up. He didn't have nothing lined up. So all my expenses doubled. And so we're getting a little off track, but it's a funny story. So I had to end up moving into this guy's house, this guy named John Pintier. He had this basement suite in Tecumseh. I moved into this basement, and I saw this ad in the Penny Saver. He was charged like $200 a month for you to rent a room from this guy. This place was the biggest dive I'd ever seen. I had to hang my food from the ceiling in a bedsheet because there were rats and mice crawling around. There was no running water. There was it was just disgusting. This guy collected garbage. He wouldn't let me use the phone. This guy was just filthy, but I needed a place to stay. There's nobody I know in wrestling who would ever, ever go through that training working a shitty job, 6 a.m. till 2 p.m., manual labor job, eating like nothing, and live in a house with rats and mice and hanging your food from the ceiling. There's nobody I know that could have gone through that except me. I couldn't even go through that right now. But that's what I did, because that's how badly I wanted to get into it. So fast forward, by the time we got to Winnipeg, Brat, he had already started wrestling, because just like everyone else in Winnipeg, you get led in through the back door. And the funny thing is, he seems to think his opinion holds the same water, like same weight as mine. When I'm like, I think all the stuff I did, all the time and money I invested into getting into this business, and I think what he invested in getting into this business, I'm thinking, you are going to say your opinion means the same as mine? I don't think so. So, of course, he hadn't even paid me back for that plane ticket. I had to chase him around. He kept changing his phone number. He locked his door. He moved 10 times. I had to take him to court, get a court order, summons him. He didn't show up at court. So I basically had to beat the money out of him with interest with a steel chair. And that's what we did in July of 2001.
So at that point, so was there hostility between the two of you during this angle? Is he somebody you wanted to work with, or were you guys able to come together professionally and make this happen?
I am always about what's good for business. And, you know, he's a guy, you know, he's just, he has some issues, you know, he had some issues at the time. You would probably admit that. I didn't hate the guy. I wasn't impressed with him that he may be, you know, it's like you do somebody a favor, they fuck you over, and then you try to get what you're owed and you feel like the dick. You know what I mean? Like, I did you a favor. Why are you making me feel like the dick? You should feel like the dick because I did you the favor. So there was a little bit of that. At that point, we had sort of buried that. But at the end of the day, I knew that I can make this guy look like $1 million, and we can do good business, and that's all I wanted to do. So, you know, sometimes there hasn't been many times where I've gotten in the ring with someone I didn't actually like. But even if I did, you know, who am I to take liberties against somebody? Like, what we do is inherently dangerous anyways. You're putting your body in the hands of somebody else, and I didn't take that lightly. So on my end, I'm pretty sure on Brad's end as well, he wasn't, you know, being rough or anything. I don't think there was any hostility there at all. But I think deep down inside, he probably... Me and Brad are polar opposites. Like, everything that he is, I'm not. Everything I am, he's not. So there's always going to be a little bit of tension there.
So you want to talk about tension. There was some tension shortly after that angle in TRCW as the rival CWF group, or at least a good majority of their roster, decided to come over to Top Rope Championship Wrestling in the middle of that war. You being at the helm of the locker room of Top Rope Championship Wrestling, what were your thoughts and opinions of the likes of Robbie Royce, Darren Dalton, Assisted Suicide, coming over to Top Rope Championship Wrestling?
I was all for it, but my thing was these guys had called our guys shit for 2 years. And now because we're kicking their ass, they want to come over here. So... You know, Bobby sort of asked the crew their thoughts, and, you know, I sort of let them know. I said, like, at the time, those guys had already quit, so they had nowhere to go. So I said, well, they quit. I'll just let them sit around, let them sweat it out for a little while. And Bobby's like, Bobby liked to stir it up. Bobby liked to, let's get them on the show right away, and we'll really show them, and we'll really show the CWF and all this, so... Anyways, those guys came over, and I was fine with it. The only issue I ever had, and this was the only time I ever said no to doing something, ever, in 15 years, was he brought Royce over. And Royce, Royce had a hard-on to work with me. So what happened was Bobby wanted Royce to go over on me. And this is the only time I ever said no. And the only reason why I said no, I didn't say no because I'm a mark for myself. I'll put anyone over any day of the week. I'll put Big O over twice on Sunday. I don't even care. It's a work, right? But Royce came over, and he had this. Royce always has his own elaborate storyline planned out. He had some great ideas, but I said I'm not putting him over. And Bobby's like, why? And he goes, because that guy called our team the shits for 2 years, and now you're gonna open your legs up like a cheap whore and bring this guy in and put him over on guys that have stuck by you and made this company number one. I said, I'm not going to do it because that's a slap in the face of the team. So I wasn't doing it. And so it never ended up working, that program with Royce. But I remember there was a tense moment in the ring where he did a promo and he said something about, I can't remember what it was. And, at the time, again, like we're working in the ring, but we're kind of shooting a little bit. And then I think I said something to the effect of Royce. I said something like, you come over here, you talk a big game, blah, blah, blah. But if I was wrestling 10 years doing the same thing, when I was 5'2", 150, fuck all. I said, I would have put a bullet in my head a long time ago. I said, you want to get in the ring with me, old man? You don't deserve the rub. I said something like that. I can't remember what it was exactly. But anyways, Royce flipped. Because back then, you don't stand up to Royce, right? No one stands up to Royce. And I didn't give a shit who he was. I mean, I had respect for the guy. But, we're working it, but we're shooting a little bit, right? And I just wanted to, I'm sticking up for my team here. I mean, these are guys who I consider friends and teammates. And we stuck together, and we weathered the CWF storm. And so anyways, Royce grabbed the stick and he said a bunch of stuff. And then, he's really shooting on me, right? And I look at DiCaprio, and DiCaprio kind of, he says to me, he goes, is he aware there's a work? So we were kind of laughing about that. And then we went to the back, and then he said something about, why don't you suck Don Callis's balls or something? And Don App happened to be in the back, actually, which was pretty funny. And then... So Don, Royce, I think Don heard him, and then that kind of buried Royce with Don some more. And I remember when I walked back, Bobby's like, why'd you do that? And then Royce was all mad, and I put all the heat on Bobby. I go, Bobby told me to do it. I just put all the heat on Bobby, and then I walked away, and that was that. And I can't even remember what happened after that. But
how long after was it until you guys were able to patch it up and work together as one cohesive unit?
You know what? It was funny. There's always a little bit tension there. And I can't really put my finger on what it is. I think Royce, wrestling's funny because wrestling is something that I did. It's not who I am. And I think because of how I look and how I portray myself, I think a lot of these guys in the business who should know better because they're the ones who shouldn't be getting worked, these guys actually buy into it. They actually think I'm who I am. They think I'm this, you know, egotistical asshole. And me and my wife were actually laughing about it because we were on one of the message boards one time, and she was reading some of this stuff, and they were bringing her name up, and she was laughing about it. And she's like, "Do these guys even know who you are?" And I'm like, "They think they know, but they really don't." So the end result is, I think Royce kind of probably bought into that whole the Mecca persona. He thought I was like that, and actually, when he sat down and talked to me, he realized, you know, I kind of know what I'm talking about. I'm not such a bad guy. So we probably had when we finally squashed everything, it was probably 4 or 5 years later, to tell you the truth. We were always sort of able to work together, but it was one of those things where, and to his credit, he took me aside and said, "Hey, you know, can we sit down and talk?" And, you know, I'm always willing to talk. And we sat down, we talked, and I told him where I was at. He told me where we were at, and we shook hands, and that was that. And, you know, to this day, you know, I think the world of the guy. He's a fucking amazing talent. You know, he's a good person. I mean, he's a family man. He's got a wife. He's got kids. He's got a, you know, he's providing for his family, and he does this. You know, like, look at the matches the guy's done. Look what he's done, you know, for all these years, and he's just keeps going. I mean, he's still going. I'm not going anymore, and he's still going. You know, so you gotta. Hats off to him. I just think it was a misunderstanding, and I think it was something that maybe even the promoters kind of stirred up a little bit to try and create a little turmoil. But me and him are good, and but back then there were some tense moments. I haven't always been. I will be the first to say I haven't always handled certain situations the best way. Just because, again, like I said, I care so much about it, and I take it so seriously, and I just want everybody just to. You know, just to be professional and try and, you know, people pay money to see this, and, you know, don't embarrass yourselves, don't embarrass the company, don't embarrass the business. And that's just my thoughts.
So you're able to overcome the war with the CWF. Top Rope Championship Wrestling had, you know, the top talent from the CWF defect over. TRCW's got a really solid crew from top to bottom. They're really starting to make some headway. And an underlying issue that people didn't understand at the time is there was a formation of a group called Premier Championship Wrestling underway. How long before the launch of Premier Championship Wrestling, while you're still working for TRCW, was this something that came to be, and why?
Well, it was October of 2001, and things were starting to slide a little bit at the Palladium, and Mike Davidson, who had great ideas at the time, he was removed as booker, and then Bobby was... you know, he was getting different guys in there, and he had Johnny Malibu booking, and he had put me, I guess, I remember this, he put me in the opening match on a show, and to be honest with you, I don't care where I am on the show. If I'm in the opening match, great. I can finish up, get changed, get showered, go have a beer, and then I'm done. You know, I don't get paid by the hour. I don't get paid, you know, where, like, if I can get done quick, I'm fine with that. But, you know, the fans were accustomed to seeing me, you know, in the main event or on later, and I remember this. I was standing in the ring after I did a job in the opening match, and I saw 13 people. I counted. They just walked out. And at the time, there was only about 50 there. So you do the math. That's a pretty good hit on your crowd. And then Bobby gave us some survey, and he gave us a survey. I probably still have a copy of this somewhere, where who would you like to see pushed? Who would you like to see booking? Who would you like to – just his thoughts. And I thought, you know, that's kind of a crummy thing to do. You're kind of dividing the locker room up, you know? I mean, there's going to be people who... I remember Brian Jewell, a guy who'd been around a long time. I remember a lot of people saying, oh, people should get rid of Brian Jewell. And I think Brian Jewell offered some value. So I thought that was kind of a crummy thing to do, and I just didn't like creatively where things were going, and I wasn't real happy. And, you know, I thought we'd sort of kind of crested, and we've plateaued, and we've got to get on to the next thing. And I thought, at the time I was working for a company... And the boss who knew I was wrestling, knew Will Damon was wrestling, and you know, he wanted a little more information about it. So I had brokered a meeting with my boss and Mike Davidson and a guy named Andrew Shawcross, and I had set the whole thing up, and we met at the round table on Pembina, and essentially to be an investor, to start something new. And then Mike and Andrew gave John the pitch. They were promptly turned down. At that point, I had to go back and massage everything and try and get John to warm up to the idea again. Got him warmed up again. Got another meeting set up. And he was like, he didn't want Andrew involved. And Mike and I said, no, I think, you know, we need to have this guy in. He brings the bar, because Andrew didn't really bring anything to the equation. He brought passion, and he brought the Palladium. That's all he brought. If he didn't have that, you know, what the hell did he bring? So I set up the other meeting, and I worked over John pretty good. And Will Damon, he was kind of just coasting at the time. He just didn't really give a shit one way or another. If he didn't wrestle again, he probably didn't care, but I still cared quite a bit. So if it wasn't, and I'll say this, and it's the truth, if I didn't work over John, that meeting wouldn't have happened, and there would be no PCW right now. So we started that thing up, and we had to get some wrestlers and get some equipment, and we had to kind of pull the wool over Bobby J's eyes to make that happen.
So why did you decide to hand this off to Mike Davidson and Andrew Shawcross? Why were they the two you selected that, hey, this is the two go-to guys to make this happen? Why isn't something yourself and Damon took over and did?
For me, I think I was just happy wrestling. I just wanted to show up, do what I'm told, and wrestle. I think Damon was the same way. I thought Mike had some good ideas. I thought Andrew had a lot of passion, and Andrew had the bar, so we had a regular venue. So, I stand behind that decision, and I thought at the time we had a good group of guys, and again, guys were still hungry. Guys still wanted it to work, but I had no, a lot of these other guys, they like to get involved in the promoting and all that stuff. I don't have time for that. Again, I always had a great job. I always made good money. I was going to school. I mean, I don't have time to piss around with this kind of stuff. So I kind of handed it off to those guys.
So Bobby J was somebody that, you know, kind of picked you guys up and you had nothing, with the formation of Top Rope Championship Wrestling. Did you have any guilt towards kind of sticking it to Bob and working behind his back to get PCW up and running?
Tons. Yeah, I had a lot of guilt. But I basically talked to Bobby and I said, we tried to get Top Rope back on track, and we tried to do things, and we tried to get him back on board and focused. And, you know, again, it's Bobby's money. It's Bobby's company. He can do what he wants. I mean, we weren't trying to fill his head with a bunch of stuff to put us over or to take over or take control. We just wanted it. We were convinced that we could get this thing hot again and get it going, but, you know, he'd let it slip a little bit. And Bobby just kept letting it, you know, go down the drain. So finally, I remember we met, it's at Burger King on Pembina, actually, just before a show. And I said, we got to do this. We got to make a decision here. And that was our last show. And I remember Bob was really upset. He was heartbroken because, you know, we had this deal where, you know, guys had to choose, and I realized, you know, we put them in a tough spot, but guys had to choose, and they couldn't do both, and so basically, Bobby lost, about 75% of his rosters. I went through, and I handpicked every single guy that came over to PCW initially. It was my call entirely, and you know, if I thought you brought something to the equation, we would take you. And if I thought you were a cancer, or if I thought you wouldn't work within the system, or if I thought that you'd be an issue, you weren't taken. So it was tough. And I remember I was the TRCW Hardcore Champion, another belt I never lost. And I remember I gave the belt to Bob, and I said, you know, I don't know what you want to do with this. I don't know if you want to, if this would screw up the lineage of the title or whatever. Or, I said, I don't know what you want to do. And he wasn't booking me. I had offered to drop it. And he didn't want to do that. He just said, Bob, it's just business. I hope you're not hot. And he goes, there's always going to be heat. And that was that. And then I went on my way, and he went on his way, and a year later, he was out of business. But it was really funny because here's a guy who 5 years ago basically looked at me and said, you know, you're not going to amount to nothing. You're going to get out of here, kid. And then over the course of 5 years, I got trained. I headlined all of his biggest shows. He put the belt on me. And then I ultimately put him out of business when I stole his ring, all his wrestlers, and his venue. So it's just funny how things happen sometimes.
So you mentioned there was, you know, wrestlers that you handpicked to be a part of the PCW team. Was there anyone specifically you didn't want a part of that team, and why? And was there any heat because of it?
There's probably more heat on other guys' ends. I mean, there's no heat on my end. For the main thing, I looked at guys who took it seriously. I don't expect anybody to take it as seriously as me. I mean, at the end of the day, it's local wrestling, right? If guys were as good as guys on TV, they'd be on TV. If guys looked locally like guys on TV, they'd be on TV. Like, I don't expect everybody to look like me or look like, you know, an underwear model. I mean, there's room for different shapes and sizes, you know, all over. But I just expect guys to take it seriously. And, you know, there were some guys, I remember, I don't think we took, we didn't take Mike Angels. And nothing against Mike. I mean, I've talked to the guy a few times. He seems to be a nice guy. I mean, he's great in the ring. But the other thing these guys got to realize, I mean, my vision of the business is different from other people's vision of the business. My vision is more along the lines of, you know, what you see on TV, because you got to appeal to the masses. I mean, you can have a great match, but if nobody gives a shit about you, no matter how good your match is, it doesn't matter. So, you know, you want to have good in-ring, but you also want to have entertainment. You want to have guys who connect with the people, guys who look like pros. I don't want to, if I'm paying money, I don't want to go watch a guy wrestle who looks like he should be sitting next to me in the crowd. And, you know, I guess Mike didn't make the cut. And I think there's still some heat there because actually a friend of mine, which is really funny, a friend of mine, she's friends with Mike Angel's, I don't know if it's his wife or his girlfriend or whatever. And she was over at their house. And then they were looking on Facebook or something, and she mentioned my name. And Mike Angel's girlfriend or wife or whatever she is, she says, "Oh, you know that guy?" And she's like, "Yeah, he's awesome. Like, he's a friend of mine." "Oh, that guy's such an asshole, right? I don't even know this person. Like, this person doesn't even know me." So here's people saying, like, "Oh, that Shane Madison guy, he's an asshole." I go, "Why? Why am I an asshole?" Because I have found somebody to invest a lucrative amount of money into a wrestling business, and I don't want him to lose his ass. And I want guys who take it seriously. I want guys who look the part. Guys who, you know what I mean? Like, that makes me the asshole. You know what I mean? So I thought that was so funny. I just laughed my ass off, and I was like, "She didn't really say that." She's like, "No, she started burying you." I go, "I don't even know this person." So again, that's just, I guess I'm doing a good job being the Mecca, because again, people are just buying into that character left, right, and center.
So you talk about taking the business seriously. For you as a performer, what were some of the things you were doing around that time to take the business seriously? Were you applying yourself to try to get into WWE or TNA or any of those companies?
You know, it's funny, actually. I never actually sent WWE like a promotional tape. Like, I sent them like a thing to get on like Tough Enough, and I ended up on their, it was a third version of Tough Enough. I ended up being selected, and they flew me down to Denver, and I had this tryout. And ultimately, what happened was Al Snow said, "You're overqualified. You've had too many matches." Because WWE kind of likes a clean slate. They don't want someone to come in here and they wrestle too much. And they think you have to reprogram this guy, and you know that turns to be a whole headache for them. That's what they think. And I told them, I said, "Hey, you know, I kind of knew that's where they were leaning." And I said, "Look, you guys, whatever you guys are doing, that's the right way to do it. Why? Because that's the way you make money. You make money doing it your way. So if you want me to do it your way, I will do it your way." But they just, I guess, thought, you know, it wasn't going to work out. So this was at a time when, you know, there was no WCW. They went tits up. ECW went tits up. So you had all these guys without a job, without a promotion. You had one company to work for. I'm a Canadian. I need a visa. Whole bunch of issues. So I've had a few meetings with them. I had Paul Bearer call me in 2001, invited me to a house show. And I remember I showed up at the house show. I had my my gear bag, and I was wearing a suit, and I remember seeing a bunch of the local guys standing there, and they saw me walking with my gear bag and my suit. There, I could just see the look on their face, like, what a fucking asshole. I'm thinking, like, why? Why am I an asshole? If Paul Bear called you guys would be all over this. Sorry's not calling you. Why is he not calling you? Maybe look in the mirror. So there was that. I went down to OVW. They had, like, 30,000 applicants, and they selected, like, 50 guys. I was one of them. And I went down there in 2004, and I realized at that time in 2004, I realized I saw the business from a different perspective, and I realized, you know what, I could probably do a lot better for myself doing what I'm doing instead of taking bumps that could kill myself and prostituting my health and my life. And you know, so I kind of made that decision at that time that, you know, I think my days are kind of numbered at this point as far as pursuing anything. But there's been things like, you know, Scott DeMore, I remember he called me, and this was back when Team Canada was starting up, and he actually had pitched that idea to me. Hey, would you be interested in this? And I said, no. And then he said, okay, well, do you got another guy? And I said, yeah. And the first guy I chose was Kenny Omega. And he says, okay, get in touch with him. And I called Kenny, and I said, get your tape, get some promotional stuff. I gave him the address for the head office in Nashville. I go, send this stuff down there. They're expecting it. You need to do it today. I need you to call me after you're done. He said, okay, I'll do it. Then I don't get a call. I'll call the next day. Did you do it? No, I didn't do it yet. Okay, listen, you're making me look bad. I vouch for you. You got to send this stuff down. Do it. Okay, I'll do it today. Doesn't do it. Doesn't do it the next day. Doesn't do it the next day. So Scott calls me. He goes, what the fuck's going on? I go, you know, I don't know. Like, again, professionalism, you know, follow up. So I don't know why Kenny didn't do it. He didn't do it. So he said, a second guy. Do you have a second guy? I go, yeah. Who? Ryan Wood. Okay, Ryan Wood, who is he? I go, well, he's a smaller guy, but he does some pretty cool shit in the ring. He'll fit in with that whole X Division stuff you guys are doing. Okay, get him, send you the stuff. And again, same thing with Woody. Didn't send the shit. So, you know, that's just local wrestling, you know. And here's Mr. Dick. You know, I'm turning down an opportunity, but I'm trying to get it to a couple other guys that I think could hit a home run, and they didn't take advantage of it.
So the Premier Championship Wrestling run didn't last too long for you, as yourself and Mike Davidson departed later in that first year. What was your decision to leave, or why was your decision to leave PCW and kickstart the initial AWE launch?
Well, we were there for, the first show was February of 2002, and then we did the Eddie Guerrero show in March of 2002. And we stayed there till, I think, 2003. And then, you know, houses started falling, blah, blah, blah. And at the time, Andrew was getting a little bit more hands-on with the creative and with the direction of the company. And Mike was a big proponent of the entertainment aspect. And Andrew was more a proponent of, you know, Ring of Honor type wrestling and stuff like that, which, you know, has its place. But, again, that's you're kind of limiting yourself to the kind of people you're going to get down to shows. So, anyways, big fallout. Mike quit, and then I quit, and I can't remember what happened. But, yeah, so we were kind of on the outside, and by 2003, and Mike started up AWE. We talked about AWE in the summer of 2003, just the logistics and getting it set up and what we're going to do and blah, blah, blah. And we had our show in November. And I think that was just the one show, and I don't think we did anything else. And then we ended up back in PCW for a little bit, like kind of back and forth a little bit. Like, people were like, oh, you know, you guys went back. And I'm like, oh, sorry for trying to better ourselves. Sorry for trying to run bigger shows. Sorry for caring. Like, if you're going to fault us for caring and for trying to run bigger shows and better names and bigger venues, like, sorry. So, you know, guys were all bent out of shape, but, you know, it is what it is. You're never gonna make everyone happy.
Was there anyone in particular in the locker room that resented you as you came back from AWE to PCW?
Oh God, tons. But the funny thing in wrestling is all these guys will all talk shit about me. Like, say Mike Angels, right? And I'll just use him as an example. I don't have any problem with Mike. You know, not a day goes by where his name ever crosses my mind. But, you know, now that we're talking about this, but like, he's a guy who probably has a problem with me, but he'll never say it. All these guys, they have problems, they never say it. You know what I mean? Somebody came up to me and said, hey, that's like Royce back in the day. Hey, do you have a problem with me? Yeah, I do. And we sat down there and we talked it out, and now we're cool. But all these guys in wrestling, they have problems with people. They don't have the balls to sit down and iron it out. So there were for sure guys. Like, it's, you know, if I went to a PCW show today, I can just see, I'd walk in there, and there'd be like, oh, Shane Massinger. That's just the way it goes. You know, I'm not, like, who am I? I'm not saying I'm a big shot. I'm not a hot dog. I try to make an impact on this business, and the fact is that people are still talking about me, so I obviously have made an impact on this business. So if you made an impact, I think that's a positive.
So it was about a year and a half later that AWE decided to give it a second go, this time on a much larger scale at the University of Manitoba. You were heavily involved, you know, getting Mike Davidson and Jeff Dick together to get this company off the ground. What are some of your thoughts and memories from this first launch, and how did it come together to be such a big scale operation?
I can't remember where I met Jeff. I can't remember what that situation was, but I remembered Jeff was looking to, I guess, diversify or do some different things. He was doing a magazine at the time, and he thought, you know, cross-promoting his magazine with wrestling would be good. He'd get some of the wrestlers in the magazine, get the magazine some exposure, blah, blah, blah. Again, I brokered a meeting for my buddy, Mike Davidson, and we met at the Perkins on Rajamouti and Regent there, and we sat down, and I introduced Mike to Jeff, and geez, I think Mike should be giving me residuals because I think he's been working for him ever since. So, so I can't remember what it was, but this was a large scale. I mean, this was pay-per-view. This was a big deal, and this was something that no one has ever done. And again, we got shit on for, oh, it's going to last three shows, it's going to last three shows. Even if it lasts one show, it's easy to stay and do the safe thing. The safe thing that's always going to be there. It's never going to go away. It's never going to grow. It's like some of the other shows, you could show up at some of those other venues and take a shit in the ring, and nobody's going to give a damn. So God forbid Mike tried to do something on a larger scale. So he got bashed for it. I got bashed for it. Everyone got bashed for it. But, you know, I can't remember exactly what happened, but we had guys like Lex Luger in here, you know, Buff Bagwell, Billy Gunn. I mean, we had some big-time big name guys in here, and you know, the shows were good, but ultimately, you know, the money dried up, and again, that's the way that Mike gets shit on. Oh, Mike, you know, like, Mike's not the guy paying for these shows. Mike's just the guy writing a lot of the shows. I mean, when the money dries up, you know, it's not Mike's fault. The money dried up. It's not on him. So a lot of that stuff was out of Mike's control, but that was a good run. They ran March of 05, they did Larger Than Life, and then they did, I think, a show in October, two shows in December. And these were on the Fight Network at the time, which was a new sort of cable channel in Canada. So, you know, it was a lot of fun, and it got people some exposure. But the worst thing is that Mike brought in all these guys, and he had these local guys on the shows. And Danny, you were on the shows, and, you know, you took it seriously. But he had guys like driving like 40 hours to get to these shows. When these stupid local guys, they couldn't be bothered. The venue's 10 minutes from their house. They're showing up late. They're showing up looking terrible. You know what I mean? You got guys who are driving, losing tons of money, driving across this country to get on these shows. And these local guys couldn't give a damn. So, you know, when Mike runs shows, and I don't expect Mike to ever run a show again, but that's why he didn't use very many local guys, because, you know, how many opportunities have these guys had, like, to be on pay-per-view and do all these things and be on TV, and no one just took it seriously. They just thought it was a joke, and so I guess, you know, yeah, it dried up, but Mike was probably a little soured on it, too.
With AWE being on the Fight Network producing pay-per-views, did you have hope and faith that this was something that was going to have some longevity to it, or was the writing on the wall very early for you?
I'm realistic when it comes to this kind of stuff. I mean, unless you're Vince McMahon, I mean, you're really not going to do anything in the business. I thought, you know, there was never any, I mean, maybe Mike thought we'd be a good, you know, number three or number four, but I mean, I knew that was never going to happen. I knew we, you know, could run our tight little shows and have a, you know, good little local Canadian crew and, you know, put on some good events, and I knew that's what it was. I wasn't expecting this thing to take off or to turn into something else. I mean, you look at companies like TNA and Ring of Honor, you look at the struggles they've had. I mean, if they can't make a go out of it, how the hell are we going to do it? So I was pretty realistic about it at that point.
Around this time, which is kind of strange timing when you look at it on a paper here, TV's happening, pay-per-view's happening, all these big stars are coming to Winnipeg to be a part of this AWE project. But it was around the time of the AWE Fight Network project, you decided to step away from professional wrestling for the first time. What fueled that decision in what would be, the height of local wrestling and its popularity at the time?
I just think that, I guess it just sort of wore me down a little bit. I mean, I just needed a break. You kind of go through these things where you kind of get stuck in a rut and, you're getting in the ring, you're doing the same thing. It seems like you're going through the motions and stuff like this. And at the time, there's young guys like, yourself, and there's, AJ Sanchez and guys like this coming up. And, it was the same thing for me. When I came here, guys like Vance Nevada probably looked over their shoulder and go, shit, I got to pick this up, And I think when you guys started, it's all about evolution. And then, probably you guys raised the bar, and guys like me are probably like, I got to pick my shit up if I'm going to compete with these guys. And, I think that maybe I was thinking, maybe this is the business sort of passed me by. I mean, I'm not really sure what it was. I just think I needed a break at that time. And, so I did my last match in December of 05, and I didn't get in the ring, I think, for over 2 years after that. I really thought that was it, but we all know how that turned out.
Thank you I think you're leading the standings of maybe retired and coming back. You and Royce are head and shoulders, so neck and neck, I should say.
I think I did retire. I retired. What? Is it even really a retirement? I mean, I'm not like I'm 80. I mean, I stopped wrestling in 05.
You take hiatuses.
Yeah, but when I stopped wrestling, then you begged me to come back for about a year, and you wore me down. So I came back in 09 for a little bit.
So you took some time off. Actually, before you came back to wrestle for me, that's not true. You were wrestling before then, or maybe it was right around the same time. You were doing some events for Ringmasters Entertainment. What caused you to come back to professional wrestling after that 2 years hiatus? And what are some of your memories working for Ringmasters?
Yeah, what happened there? I was going through something, in my life where it was a pretty life-changing event, and I think I needed something to fall back on to kind of maybe forget about some of the other shit that's going on. So I think I was in Brandon. Was it Brandon with you and Mike? And you guys were bugging me to bring my gear, and I brought my gear. I don't even know why I brought it. But I brought it just to kind of appease you guys. And I swear to God, I wasn't planning on wrestling. Because if I was, I didn't bring any wrist tape. I didn't bring any olive oil. I didn't bring anything like this to any sort of anything like that. And that's, I didn't bring a towel. I didn't bring any of this stuff. And, or maybe I did that because that was my out. I don't know what happened. But anyways, they were short a guy. They needed a guy. I had my gear. And they threw me in a tag match. I did a tag match. I worked against Chevy and Sanchez, which was a lot of fun. So I think that's kind of, it was just one show. That was it. And then I think that was in October of 08 or something, and I didn't do anything until I hooked up with you in February of 09.
And that would begin the CWE chapter of the Mecca Shea Madison's career. Unfortunately, we're out of time on this week's episode. We're just scratching the surface of the Mecca Shea Madison and his involvement in Manitoba wrestling and its history. So we're going to have you back on the line in the next couple of weeks, and we'll pick this up where we left off and get to hear more about your story.
There's lots more heat to cause, so that's part one. Stay tuned for part two. It's going to get real interesting.
Thank you very much for tuning into this week's edition of Elite Wrestling Radio. We're back next week with Tennessee wrestling star Sigmund live on the show.